Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Good, good. So I want to thank the organizers of the Hey Festival and thank all of you for coming. It's a great privilege to be here. It's wonderful to be sitting in this beautiful auditorium, this beautiful theater. It must be one of the most beautiful in South America. And this city must be one of the most beautiful in South America. And there's a great charge, I think, that we all feel being here together, contemplating the arts, contemplating the deepest questions, thinking our deepest thoughts, connecting with life. And for me, writing about science has always been a way of trying to bring whatever we can learn from science into that central place where we experience our lives. That it shouldn't be someplace far away, it shouldn't be some source of strange and slightly oppressive authority, something in the textbooks to be put away with the textbooks, but really something that should inform and change our lives. And not only the circumstances of our lives through technology and through medicine, but also our experience of our lives, our experience of what it means to be alive. And all of that drew me to writing the story that is in my latest book, Long for This World. And I want to thank the people of Galaxia Gutenberg for arranging the translation into Spanish. I thought as I approached middle age, as I realized that I was well into middle age, actually, that this was a subject I wanted to contemplate, that I wanted to talk with scientists about what aging is, what longevity can be, and even at the greatest extremes, whether biology can ever really aspire to immortality. It was a subject that drew me, and as I began to write, I was reminded again and again that it's a subject that draws all of us and that is at the core of so much of the arts in whatever genre of writing, for instance, that people are engrossed in, you find this theme again and again. I teach at Columbia University. I'm a writer who writes about science and who teaches the writing of science to students at Columbia. And so while I was writing, I used to go out of the campus. This is the other Columbia, the Columbia in New York City. I'd walk out. I'd go out on Broadway to the bookstore there and pick up a book, one of the new books from the table. And again, I would open the book, and there was the theme I was writing about in the pages of a novel or the pages of a book of poetry. For instance, Gary Steingard, who also is a writer at Columbia University, had just published his latest novel, Super Sad True Love Story. And I opened it when it arrived at the store. I opened it to the first page, and the first line was, "Dear Diary, today I have made a major decision. I am never going to die." And then another day, I picked up John Updike's book, Endpoint, a collection of his last poems. And my eyes fell on the line, a beautiful line, very poignant and paradoxical, typical of Updike. He wrote, "God save us from ever dying, though billions have." And then, of course, there are the immortal lines of Woody Allen. Every biologist I've talked with, everyone who studies longevity and the perpetuation of life, the extension of life, loves to quote Woody Allen on this subject. Woody Allen said, maybe you've heard this, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying." And he also said, "As long as they are mortals, human beings will never be completely relaxed. So we're talking about an ancient problem. We're talking about a problem here, the problem of mortality, that in fact has engrossed and engaged writers as from the very moment that people learned how to write. The moment people began writing stories, in culture after culture, the first story they told was the story we're here to talk about this morning, the story of figuring out a way to conquer death and to live forever. You see that story, for instance, in the myth of Gilgamesh, the Babylonian epic, which seems to have been the first story written, you know, in cuneiform on clay tablets. People had been keeping accounts, people had been writing about how much they sold this barrel of grain to that merchant in the clay tablets. The moment they wrote a long story, the story was this great prince Gilgamesh, and how he became dissatisfied with all of the wealth and power in his kingdom and wandered off into the desert looking for the secret of eternal youth. And poor Gilgamesh almost found it right there in that first story. He had it in his hands and then he lost it and he had to go back and all he had left was the tale. And again, the story of Adam and Eve, one of the oldest stories ever told. And there too, Adam and Eve aspired toward immortality. You remember, we all remember how they reached for the fruit of the tree of knowledge and God threw them out of the garden. That's why he expelled them from the garden, because he was afraid that they would eat of the tree of knowledge and they would become immortal like the angels. And so they had to go and they had to be mortal and forever after mortal. And again, you see this story, culture after culture. And that's the story that now begins again, but with the new power of, the extraordinary power of molecular biology, the advances of the last 100 years and more in modern medicine, and a new sense of hope, power, possibility, and even a certain dread. Some of the fear, some of the caution, some of the confusion that you find right from the beginning in those very oldest stories. So I'll tell you how I first encountered a serious biologist who was taking this problem seriously, the question of aging and the conquest of aging. He was a wonderful old biologist. When I met him, he was almost 80 years old. His name was Seymour Benzer. He taught at Caltech, California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. And he had an extraordinary career. He was a man who had hopped from question to question, field to field in the course of his life and worked wonders again and again. So as a very young kid, you know, in his early 20s, he had worked on what became the transistor in the early years of World War II and helped start the electronics revolution, helped start the computer revolution. Then he decided he was more interested in biology than physics. He, with James Watson and Francis Crick and a few other young Turks, young revolutionaries, started the field of molecular biology, the science of the gene. Then Seymour became a parent, and he noticed that his second little girl, when she was in the crib, even when she was just a week old, was incredibly different in personality from his first little girl. And he thought, my wife and I can't have made that much difference in this person's life in the matter of 3 or 4 days. There has to be something in the genes to have made such a difference in the personality of these two little babies. And so he decided, since he was a maven of genetics and of DNA, he decided to go look in the DNA to try to find springs and sources of the differences between all of us and our personalities. And he made extraordinary progress there. It's a very complicated and somewhat fraught field, as you may know. But he made significant progress. I wrote about that in my book, Time, Love, Memory. So I was visiting Seymour in his laboratory, and Seymour started telling me about his latest hop. He was now going to hop one more time. Again, he's almost 80 years old now. One more time from the study of genes and behavior to the study of genes and longevity. And he told me that the work was still unpublished at the time, that he had engineered a Methuselah fly, a fruit fly that lived about twice as long as the fly was meant to live in the fly bottle. And that Methuselah fly he had engineered by tweaking just a single gene. And so he talked to me with this wonderful conspiratorial sort of voice, because it was so science fiction-like to be saying what he was saying. But he said, look, if we can do that for a fly, maybe we can start to learn to do something like that for ourselves. And he would lower his voice, and it was like we were talking as if we were two prisoners in two adjoining cells, you know, in the prison of mortality. And he thought, there really might be a way we can dig a tunnel out of here, you know? That was the way he talked. I think we really might be able to do something about this, about aging. I think we really might. And Seymour wasn't alone. There was also a serious and very fine biologist at work, a much younger one, named Cynthia Kenyon, also in California, in San Francisco, who had done the same trick with worms, certain laboratory worms called C. elegans, which are these tiny transparent worms. She had changed one gene in C. elegans, and she'd made it live more than twice as long. So, talking to people like that, I started to realize that there's something solid and serious here to think about. It's not just mythology, it's really possibility, or at least serious biologists are beginning to think so. So I looked around for a character. Now, I write nonfiction, but I try to use all the tools of the novelist in my writing, and I try to find a main character, someone who will embody the questions, someone who's not only pursuing the problem, but somehow in his or her life embodies the subject at hand. So I talked to many of the leaders in this study, this little field of life extension, and I knew I'd found my guy when I met a man named Aubrey de Grey. I wonder if any of you have heard of Aubrey de Grey. Since I met him, it's about 10 years ago, he's become quite famous. In fact, he may have lectured in this very hall. He's really is the embodiment of the subject. He's a highly eccentric biologist who lives in Cambridge, England. He is the spitting image of Methuselah. He's 6 feet tall. He's as thin as a medieval saint. He has that pallor in his face. He has a beard down to here. He believes that many of us here in this hall have the chance to live 1,000 years, or if we're very lucky, 10,000 years, and perhaps a few of us 1,000,000 years or live forever. So clearly, if I was going to put Aubrey at the center of my book, I wasn't going to be writing about someone I agreed with 100%. I was going to be confronted with the problem that in literary criticism is called the problem of the unreliable narrator. And I try to signal that at the start of my book by beginning with a huge argument that Aubrey and I had at a pub, one of his favorite pubs in Cambridge, England, the Eagle, which is where Watson and Crick ran when they discovered the structure of the gene, the double helix. And Crick was yelling, "We found the secret of life. We found the secret of life." So Aubrey lives in Cambridge. He loves that pub, the Eagle, partly as a frame for his rather grandiose sense that he too has found the secret of life and that he's here to tell us that we can live forever. And Aubrey and I argue in that first scene at the pub. I should mention that Aubrey likes to meet writers and reporters in pubs. He basically lives in pubs. He basically lives on beer from morning till night. And it's very hard to keep up with Aubrey. So, and that's part of the secret, but it's only part of the secret. And I want to say right at the outset in talking about this that although I find some aspects of Aubrey's passion for immortality amusing, I think we all share that passion for immortality at some time or another. And intellectually, Aubrey is certainly not a crazy person. Aubrey has many, many interesting ideas which serious people in biology like Seymour Benzer or Cynthia Kenyon or many others are interested to hear about. And some of them write published papers, technical papers with Aubrey. He hosts conferences in Cambridge, which all of the leaders of the field are happy to attend. So we're talking about a complicated character, a character who is not to be taken entirely seriously, and yet who is both thought-provoking and a fountain, if not a fountain of youth, a fountain of interesting and valuable ideas and theories. And that I tried to get across. So that's why I put Aubrey at the center. Now let me read you just a very short passage. It'll give you a flavor of my encounters with Aubrey. At the time I met Aubrey, I lived in a small town in Pennsylvania. I now live in New York City, teaching at Columbia, but back then I was an independent writer in this little village in Pennsylvania. And I invited Aubrey to stop by for a day or two. He was on his first lecture tour in the United States. I invited him to stop by for a day or two to explain what he was about. I picked him up at the airport in Philadelphia, and as he huddled in the death seat of my car, enduring the curves of our country roads, we were winding our way toward my house in Bucks County, the poor man's face looked pale to the roots of his hair and beard, corpse gray in the cheeks. His head tilted toward the window as if toward martyrdom. He'd never learned to drive, he told me when I asked him if he was all right. He couldn't help feeling frightened in cars. That's how everyone will feel, he said, when they realize that they may have hundreds or even thousands of years ahead of them. Once that truth sinks in, it will be hard to find anyone on earth who is willing to ride in an automobile, much less a police car or a fire truck. Too much life ahead, too much time to lose. So let's ask ourselves, what are we really talking about here when we talk about aging? There are two questions that biologists ask when they ask that question, and we really need to understand both of them if we're going to make any progress with this ancient problem. The first is, what is aging? That is, what's going on in our bodies that makes us different, feel different, look a little different, more susceptible, unfortunately, to problems, diseases, with each passing decade? What is that? I mean, we're all very, very good common sense scientists of aging because it's so central to our experience. We can look around ourselves at any moment, anywhere we are, and we can judge all the people we see around us. We can judge their ages pretty closely, right? I mean, almost always you can tell somebody's age, sometimes within a couple of years. A few people startle us. Mostly we know. But what is it that we're talking about? What is that change? I was really surprised when I started looking into this for the book that biologists can't actually answer that question. In some ways, this is one of the great mysteries still, what aging is. In some ways, it's an even harder problem than the question, what is consciousness? I mean, as I say in the book, with consciousness, we've at least narrowed down the source of the mystery. We know that it's coming from a place somewhere above the neck. That we know. Exactly how the brain makes consciousness, we can't say. But we know it's coming from the brain. Where's aging coming from? What changes are most important that drive the rest? Nobody really knows. Is it happening in every one of our cells in our bodies? Is it happening in just a few and that drives all the rest? Is it just one chemical change? Is it a zillion and an uncountable number of changes that take place more or less at random? If it's all more or less at random, then how come we age in such predictable ways so that we can look around again and gauge everybody's ages so easily? So what is it? We don't know. But then there's a second question that biologists do have a very strong handle on, and that is, why? Why did aging evolve? Why are we mortal rather than immortal? The evolutionary story emerged roughly around the time of World War II. The greatest biologist in the origins of the theory of aging is a man called Sir Peter Medawar. He was a British Nobel Prize winning immunologist and also a theorist of biology. And he was the one who figured out a really very simple answer to the question, why do we age? The reason aging evolved is that life is tough, and that life was extremely tough in the wild. In the natural world, very, very few individuals live long enough to reproduce. It's a small fraction of the animals and plants out there that make it to the age of reproduction and pass on their genes. Because we now are so much better at protecting ourselves, coddling our children, nourishing ourselves, more and more of us live well past the age of reproduction. But back in the days of the caves, this was rare. I mean, if a gathering like a gathering of this size had taken place in one of the grand theatrical caves of prehistory, you would not have seen so many of us who were so many years beyond puberty. The average age that people could expect back in the cave days was about 21, 22. It was very, very rare for someone to live significantly longer than that. So there was no point in all those millions of years that evolution by natural selection shaped our ancestors' bodies. There was no point in building them to last much beyond the age of reproduction, because that would be a waste of energy and resources. Yes, if one of our ancestors from 500,000 years ago, if one of our ancestors had the enormous good fortune, extremely rare good fortune, to live, say, to the age of 40, she might have begun to experience aches and pains in the knees or in her back. But that was one in, who knows, one in 100, one in 1,000. There weren't enough people living long enough to experience the problems of aging for it to matter in terms of evolution. And so, as with every other line of life, evolution built us to be incredibly fit, incredibly strong and resistant to disease and energetic in our youth. And then evolution more or less looked the other way. Whatever happened after that, happened after that. It really didn't matter anymore. It's like building disposable goods. We're essentially built to be disposable, to grow up quick, to be strong and vigorous and competitive around puberty and for maybe the 10 years afterward that we're raising our kids, living again by the old timetable of prehistory. And then after that, we really don't matter very much. Unless perhaps the contributions of the grandfather and the grandmother can help the grandchildren survive, then maybe there's some benefit there. And some theorists talk about that. They call it the grandmother hypothesis. But by and large, we were built to be disposable. And now, what we confront, whatever the nature of all these changes is in our bodies, we confront a problem that evolution itself never cared about. So I hope that's clear. That is one of the great lessons, really, of 20th century biology, and I'm surprised it isn't better known, because I think it informs your sense of yourself. It challenges your sense of yourself. So, one could add that, and if you're an optimist like Aubrey, you do add, that there's a tremendously optimistic note there, as well as the rather grim idea that we're disposable. There's a very hopeful note for anyone who wants to engineer an immortal life, and that is that it's already happened. Each of us has already experienced that period of extraordinary youth, around the time we were 11, 12, 13, 14, right in there. We were so healthy at that point that if we could have preserved that level of health, we would have gone on for about 1,000 years. Actuarial tables show that it is so rare for a child of that age to contract a fatal illness. Aside from accidents, if you can avoid accidents, you will go on, if you are at that healthy and stay that healthy, you will go on for 1,000 years. And some people, since there's always a bell curve here with extremes at the edges, some of the most lucky will go on for, will live for 10,000 years. So Aubrey would say, it's not as if we're trying to do something that we haven't done already. We just have to stay as healthy as we did at 12 or 13 or 14. Now, that just has a little bit of comedy in it, of course, because that just is just what people have dreamed of since the time of Gilgamesh and before Gilgamesh. That just is eternal youth. But it is interesting to note that we have been there. We actually have been there. We have already achieved that level of permanence for a brief period. So could we figure out what that is? Could we figure out what changes? And could we steer closer to that, close enough that we ourselves would still have the chance to live 1,000 years or more? So Aubrey's argument is that there are maybe 7 categories of decline that come into this picture of aging, and that all we need to do, and again, there's a little bit of comedy in that, all we need to do, but all we need to do is solve each of those 7 problems, and we will live the 1,000 years or the 10,000 years. And Aubrey has made very interesting, provocative suggestions to deal with each of those 7 points in his 7-point program. Now, I'm not going to inflict the entire 7-point program on you this morning. It's a lot for a Sunday morning. But let me tell you one, because it gives you the flavor of what Aubrey's thoughts are like, and because it sounds extraordinarily bizarre at first, and then maybe you will agree with me, comes to sound more commonsensical the more you think about it. So here's Aubrey's idea. One of the things that happens as we get older, that's happening unfortunately in all of our cells, in all of our bodies here in this room right now, is that we get less capable, our cells get less capable of cleaning up the trivial little bits of garbage that are the byproducts of our metabolism as we go along, as the cells live. Every metabolic process, as you burn oxygen to give yourself energy in your cells, as you use some of that energy to turn your breakfast into molecules that will help you rebuild and will give you more, again, give you more energy. All of that metabolic churning, those factories, produces a little bit of pollution. Those factories pollute very slightly. And our cells no longer clean up that pollution as well when we're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and on, as they did when we were 12. It's one of the changes that you can see. When you look through a microscope, you can see that beginning to build up. It's almost like we have a little bit of slang, dust bunnies, like the dust bunnies under the bed, or in the corners of the room where it's hard for the broom to get to sweep. The equivalent is happening in the nooks and crannies of our cells right now. And those dust bunnies, those bits of dust, are ugly, crumpled, nasty little heaps of molecules that the cell just doesn't know how to take apart. Our cells have all kinds of tools. I call them brooms, but they're also like enzymes that are like scissors to snip up clumps of junk and make them into smaller pieces that can then be swept into a sort of garbage disposal, which every cell contains. We just aren't good enough at it after a while. The garbage builds up. Some biologists have suggested that that's the key change that's taking place in us that is driving our aging. They call it the garbage catastrophe, because the more garbage there is, the less well the factories run, the less well the cell does its work, so therefore there's still more garbage, and it's a vicious circle, and we age and we die. Well, why is it that our cells don't have just the right enzymatic scissors or brooms to keep up with all that trash? Why not? Again, it's because there was no need for them. In the long sweep of time in which our bodies evolved, there was no need for them because very, very few people lived long enough for that kind of dust to build up under the bed. It was, you know, we were only here for a very short time. So Aubrey asked himself, where on earth might there be organisms that have solved this problem, that have found the scissors to cut up that junk and dispose of that junk and metabolize that indigestible junk in ourselves? And he came up with a novel answer. Now remember, Aubrey lives in Cambridge, England, which is one of the older villages in England, with graveyards that go back centuries upon centuries upon centuries, that put all the antiquities of the New World to shame. And Aubrey thought, that's where to dig for this secret. In the soil of these ancient graveyards, there are microbes that must have specialized over the last centuries in consuming every last bit of nourishment from every last corpse that has been buried in the graveyards of Cambridge. They know how to do it. They know how to eat up what we ourselves are not able to metabolize. So all we have to do, Aubrey said, and this is a simpler all we have to do is dig up some soil from one of those ancient graveyards of Cambridge, cultivate the microbes, feed them some purified dust bunnies, some of the pure crud that builds up in aging cells, and see if there are microbes that are particularly good at digesting it, growing on it. If there are, they have the secret that might give us clues to the invention of some sort of pill, some sort of drug that could help us cleanse our bodies. So, a truly bizarre idea. Really a kind of a weird idea, and yet also a very practical idea. And if you know the field of biology, you know that something quite similar has already been in progress. A research program has been in progress for decades. It's called bioremediation. There are people who are trying to cultivate bacteria to get rid of other piles of junk around us, outside us, the toxic waste dumps of the world. And the idea is, dig in the soils around toxic waste dumps, maybe you'll find bacteria that have figured out how to digest some of the awful pollutants that we've left in the toxic waste dumps, or culture bacteria in the laboratory, giving them for nourishment only the toxic waste we would love to break down and get rid of. And see if you can find bacteria that can help us clean up the dumps. So one of the leaders in bioremediation, a scientist in Arizona, is interested enough in Aubrey's idea that as a sort of side project, a Saturday project or a Sunday project, he's taken it up and he has students working on it, young scientists, and they're looking for ways of cleaning up the toxic wastes in our own bodies the same way they look for ways to clean up uranium tailings or the piles of junk in Fresh Kills, the biggest dump outside my city of New York. So it's real. It's a real work in progress, and it comes from a quite zany idea of Aubrey's. So what else is real here, I want to ask? That's the question that I come to again and again when I contemplate this subject. There's so much that has still that sense of mythology and science fiction about it. What's real and solid and happening right now? First of all, clearly, we're all living longer lives as it is. Our life expectancy is changing as we speak. And that is a real phenomenon. I mean, it's quite a dramatic change. It's one of the most significant changes ever to have taken place in human history. In 1900, in all of the most developed countries in the world, where people had access to the latest in medicine, the average life expectancy of a baby born in one of those countries was about 47 years old. Only about 47. The reason was that you were so likely to lose that baby to disease before the baby even reached puberty. And so many mothers in 1900 were likely to die giving birth to those babies. We didn't have antibiotics yet. We didn't have a clear idea about the importance of hygiene in operating rooms. We didn't have the good nutrition, the good public sanitation that was developed later over the next decades. Only 47. Steadily over the 20th century, life expectancy advanced and advanced and advanced to the point that a baby born at the end of the 20th century, again, in the fortunate populations on the planet with access to the most advanced medicine, a baby born in 1999, 2000, had a life expectancy of about 77 is the estimate, pushing 80. And that life expectancy continues to advance. Demographers estimate that we continue to advance in our life expectancy more or less on a straight line and a sharply rising line since 1900 to the present. Now, it's always hard to look into the future, notoriously, but projecting ahead, if we keep on that line of progress, we can expect that our children will have longer life expectancies than we do, and our grandchildren, and so on. These advances, at least so far, are real and are enormous. They matter hugely to us. We're the first generations of human beings, in fact, to be aware that with each passing decade, life expectancy is increasing. I mean, we all know about it. We all try to plan for it, although it's very hard to plan for it. What does this mean? How much longer will I live beyond my retirement, for instance? Will those be good years or not? Those are all questions that confront us because of this rising life expectancy. Now, an optimist like Aubrey argues that from that, you can't just extrapolate on a straight line. He says, science and medicine keep advancing very rapidly at an exponential rate. You know, that's going up on a sharp curve like this, not just on a straight line. So if we keep living longer and science and medicine keep getting better and better at preserving our lives, then maybe we'll reach a point of escape velocity, as he likes to say, when we when we escape entirely from the constrictions of mortality and we begin to live more or less forever. Because each time a problem develops, well, science and medicine is right there to catch us and help us and keep us going. And then another problem develops, and again, science and medicine have found a cure for that too. That's the optimistic vision. But the real thing that's happening now, we all know about it, is this extraordinary increase in life expectancy that forces the importance of this field, the study of aging. Another real thing that's happening, the clues that people have found so far, just in the last 5-10 years, to what it is we're talking about when we talk about aging, are very interesting because they seem to point towards some kind of a universal hub in the wheel, some kind of central change that might be driving the rest. It's known, and many of you have probably heard about this, that with calorie restriction, with putting laboratory animals on a semi-starvation diet, they will live longer, healthier lives. And they'll seem to have more energy. You know, the laboratory rat that hasn't been overfed will still be going around and around on the exercise wheel in its cage when the fat, sluggish laboratory rat that had all it could eat and more has long since died. So if you look in the cells of that rat, the rat that's put up with very low rations, and has still somehow become healthy, stayed healthy through this long life, you see the same kinds of molecular patterns as you see in studies of these long-lived mutants, like I mentioned at the outset, the long-lived Methuselah fly or the Methuselah worm, or even there's Methuselah yeast, believe it or not. The same kinds of biochemical changes, the same metabolic pathways are affected. It's in the jargon, it has to do, it's called the insulin-dependent signaling pathway. And what that means is it has to do with the cell's ability, our cell's ability to sense whether there are nutrients around. And you see that with the calorie restriction, and you also see it in lab analysis of these Methuselah mutants. So maybe they're getting somewhere. Maybe they're getting at some central change, which then biologists will be able to come up with a pill to effect, to change. Most of us don't want to have longer lives if it's going to mean being half starved every day. But maybe we can have our cake and eat it too. Maybe we can have the pill and get the effects. Maybe. There are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent right now by big pharmaceutical companies in pursuit of that maybe. So that much, again, is real. A sense of glimmering sense of possibilities here at the level of biochemistry where you can start to invent drugs. What else is real? We have a crisis, global crisis, in country after country because of the successes of life extension. We have this phenomenon that some people call global graying, which unfortunately is progressing about as fast as global warming. And there are many countries that are in which politicians have to worry a great deal about the aging of the population. There aren't enough young people around to support all those aging older people, and will we arrive at some kind of demographic crisis? That also is real. That's a consequence of the real advances in biology and medicine and public sanitation and the rest over the last 100 years and more. And finally, what's real, I think, is for all of us, this sense that now science begins to have a handle on this ancient problem and this innermost question that we all carry around with us every single day. And I would say what's real is that we now have to deal with that, each of us ourselves inside. We need to deal with that in some way and to confront again maybe with new eyes, our own sense of mortality. So where do you go with that? I have to say that after all those arguments with Aubrey in the pub, the biologist I ended up feeling most kinship with was a biologist named Martin Raff, who disagreed violently with Aubrey about this problem of mortality and immortality. Martin Raff is a retired biologist in London, University College London, very distinguished career. Martin made a name for himself in a number of fields, but one of them was the problem of cell suicide. It's called in the jargon apoptosis, but it's cell suicide. Cells in our bodies know when it's time to go, and they go. And Martin helped understand what's going on, how they sense that, and what they do about it. And Martin, possibly partly inspired by that research, although he claims it's a completely separate thing, Martin has a sense that mortality is really a precious gift, and that he himself would be really depressed if somebody came up to him right now and offered him that immortality pill. He doesn't expect to be offered it in his lifetime, and he doesn't want it. And he said to me, "I've had a really good life. I've enjoyed every stage of my life. I'm enjoying this stage of my life. And I have a few more chapters if I'm lucky, and I want to enjoy each of those. But how long can I go on being this lucky?" he said. "I've been spared in my life most of the miseries. Not all, but most of the horrors." You can't keep that up, that kind of luck, for 500 years or 1,000 years. So I'm concentrating on making the most of this stage and the next stage, and that's what I want for my life. And that gives him a feeling of kinship, not only with all the generations before him, but with all of the living world and all of the cosmos around us, because the cosmos is a cosmos of change, perpetual change. Everywhere you look, you know, in every discipline of science, from astronomy down to subatomic physics, you see this fizzing, intense, constant change, cosmic evolution, biological evolution. Evolution is a matter of constant change. Nothing stays the same. And so we're part of that. And I found Martin's view inspiring. I didn't want to argue with Martin quite as much as I wanted to argue with Aubrey. But I have to say, I feel as conflicted about this as maybe you do also. I argued with Martin too, because Martin said, "I mean, I wouldn't take that pill." He said, "Would you? Would you?" And I'm left with the question, would I? I don't know. I think we're all full of conflicting yearnings here. There's what I call in the book the everlasting yes and no. And we're torn between the two, and each have powerful claims on us. And so part of the gift of this research and looking into this subject, at least for me, has been a chance to sort out that conflict between the everlasting yes and no in us, which is at least as complicated as the biological question at the heart of the cell that's driving our aging. Well, I could go on forever. I want to allow time for questions. Woody Allen has another line. He says, "Eternity is a long time, especially toward the end." So thank you very much. We have time for a few questions.
Hi there. I read recently a short note that said that even though we can live longer, the quality of our life has decreased because of sickness, disease, and whatnot. What do you think about that?
It's a difficult question. I don't know if everybody could hear it. We're living longer, but is the quality of our lives decreasing? Look, we're living longer in large part because the quality of our lives is increasing. So you have to say that at the outset. But I think what you're asking is the quality of those last years or that last decade or so. Is that a decade we really want to be living? Is that a decade in which we're glad to still be alive? And there, the answer is more complicated. I mean, we all know people who have reached a point where, at least from the outside, it doesn't look like such a great gift to be living that way at the age of 80, let's say, or 90. And so that does represent one of the great paradoxes of this effort to extend our lives. Are we giving ourselves a gift we want? The optimists in this field say that what we want to do is not extend our lives to the point where they don't feel worth living, but to extend our healthy years and to give ourselves more and more healthy decades. And there's no question that we have done that. I remember when I was finishing this book, I picked up Montaigne's last essay, and near the start of the essay, he says, I don't remember the exact number, but he says, here I am, I've reached the age of 47, I've lived a good life, I'm content to go whenever I go. And I thought, you know, I'm really glad that I live now and not then, and a writer can still hope to write a couple more essays and have some good productive years left. So that period of good years certainly has continued to increase greatly since the time of the Renaissance. And with it, unfortunately, comes the tail end when we're not so glad of the gift. And how we deal with that, that's one of the great problems ahead for medicine and the science of aging. Somebody have the microphone? I don't know who's circulating. We have a question here, or a question back there, I guess.
Buenas.
Yes.
Bueno, la conferencia ha sido sobre...
Un momento. Pardon.
Sobre el envejecimiento, en teorías muy claramente expuestas, pero en la práctica, lo que nosotros diariamente vivimos, entre esas personas, pues yo recuerdo que cuando yo tenía la edad de mis nietos, mi abuela era una anciana totalmente deteriorada. Hoy en día yo soy una abuela que me siento joven. Me siento joven, me siento vital, ejerzo una profesión y hasta aquí la cosa va muy bien. Pero definitivamente voy a envejecer. No me da miedo envejecer. Me da miedo deteriorarme y me da miedo en la medida en que ni siquiera me asusta lo de morirme. A mí, yo sé que me tengo que morir. Lo que me da pánico, terror, es no poderme morir. Quedarme en una condición en que aun cuando esté consciente o inconsciente, tenga que depender de otras personas. Ese es un punto para mí muerto, en que la persona debía tener la oportunidad de, si no poderse mantener 100 años o 1000 años, por lo menos terminar dignamente una vida. Ese es mi temor. ¿Hasta cuándo y hasta dónde podemos permanecer jóvenes, permanecer vitales y permanecer dignamente en la vida? Gracias.
That was just beautifully put. Thank you. So this too is one of the great issues of this new science of aging and this new stage we're in. I mean, we're given more and more good years, and we joy in those years, and we can continue to contribute in those years, but our nightmare is that we will outlive that stage and arrive, as you say, at some sort of dead point at which it's no longer worthwhile. Martin Raff, who I was talking about at the end of my lecture, is very concerned about that question, and he's active in the Hemlock Society, and he feels that we all need to think and plan ways of exiting gracefully when we have reached that point. I think about that also. And I certainly don't want to end on this grim note when we're talking about the paradoxes of immortality, but this is one of the darkest sides of the subject, and it's not new to us by any means. If you look at Jonathan Swift, for instance, he wrote a very powerful satire in which he talks about a group of people who have figured out how to live forever, but not how to preserve themselves, and they deteriorate to the point where it's just ludicrous and they themselves can't enjoy their lives. And you can go back even to the time of ancient Greece, the myth of Tithonus. I don't know if you've heard of the story of Tithonus. He was, I think, a Trojan prince, and the goddess of the dawn fell in love with him, and she asked Zeus to make him immortal so that she could bring him up to Olympus. And Zeus did, but she forgot to ask her father, Zeus, to also give him eternal youth. And he shriveled and shriveled and shriveled away until finally he was like a little grasshopper just cheeping in a cage. She put him in a grasshopper cage, and she kept him on the shelf. So what you're talking about is the nightmare of the Tithonus scenario, in which we give ourselves more and more opportunities to age to the stage of Tithonus, and nobody wants that. But I want to say on the cheerfuler side of the subject that there is an important lesson here that brings up for medical research. We spend so many dollars in medical research on the study of specific diseases of old age, the diseases that become likelier and likelier as we get older. Cancer, heart disease, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. We, with justice, spend fortunes trying to fight those diseases. But why shouldn't we also spend some fraction of that amount on the study of whatever it is that's changing in our bodies that makes those diseases more likely when you get, say, to my age, when you're about to turn 60? All of those diseases of late life become more and more probable with each passing year. Why is that? What is it that's changing? And if we could understand that and fight that, then those research dollars would be fighting at one stroke all of those late onset diseases at once. It would be a wonderful, wonderful act of preventive medicine. And it seems to me that we should be devoting a significant fraction of our research dollars to that study. But having said that, I realize that there's very, very little difference between saying that and saying what Aubrey says, that we should be trying to live forever. The paradox, you know, is with us full blown when we once make that statement. And yet it seems to me perfectly commonsensical, perfectly straightforward as a research program. Do we have time for one more question?
profesor Jonathan, gracias por estar con nosotros. El hombre es unidad corpórea y vital. En su teoría, muy cuantificable, habla de basura, célula, microorganismo, laboratorio. Pregunta, ¿dónde ubicamos el concepto o categoría de esencia, sustancia, alma como fuentes de trascendencia cósmica?
That's a beautiful, beautiful question to end on. Thank you. You know, that's within us. That comes from us. And that sense of cosmic eternity, I hope, is not entirely different from the view that you get talking with the biologists. I mean, I get a sense of cosmic eternity partly by thinking about this long evolutionary path that's led us here, and partly by thinking about the extraordinary miracle that each of us is and that we're alive now. And to think about all these questions enhances, I think, our sense of life and our sense of the extraordinary gift and miracle and beauty of life that you're describing. So maybe that's the place we should stop, with a sense of the celebration of life itself. Thank you.